Marseille, and he will tell us about dynamical chaos and the volume gap.
Hello everyone, and thank you for the invitation to speak today. I'll be speaking about work that appeared just last week in PRD, and throughout the slides I have archive references that are hyperlinked if you want to look at any of the papers. I'd like to begin the talk with three puzzles. So if you go to the next slide, I'll talk about the first one. The first puzzle is framed by a quote from a recent review of Hermann Nicolai called Quantum Gravity, the View from Particle Physics. And while you read that quote, I'll just double check that you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Wonderful. All right. So he's emphasizing the importance of the problem of gravitational divergences. And this is a very interesting question for all of us. And he continues the review to discuss a little bit about the recent discovery of the scalar boson at the LHC. He notes that this, the measured mass of this boson, if it indeed it is the Higgs, falls in a range such that it avoids two interesting bounds. One of these is provided by the lower dark curve in the figure, which is the vacuum instability, and the upper dark curve in the figure, which is the lambda pole of self-coupling. By avoiding these two bounds, the mass of the Higgs tells us that it's possible that the currently known physics is correct all the way up to the Planck scale. So this supports the point of view that quantum gravity may have something very important to say about these divergences. So the second puzzle appears on the next slide, and this has a much narrower focus. And I'm interested in asking whether indeed the volume gap. It's been known for some time that the volume operator has a discrete spectrum. And in the case of the area operator, we know that there's a gap separating the zero eigenvalue of area from its nearest neighbor. And there have been some questions raised in the literature as to whether the same is true of the volume spectrum. So at first glance, this question seems a little puzzling. We know there's a discrete spectrum, so how could there not be a volume gap? So I want to give you a sort of simple picture of this on the next slide, slide 3. So the simplistic model is to consider both the range of possible volumes and the number of levels in that range. Both of these quantities depend on the spin J. So at the top of the slide, I've given you the formula for the dimension of the intertwiner space. This is the number of levels in terms of the characters of SU2. And just to give a very simple calculation, if you calculate this dimension for 5 equal areas, you find that it scales at highest order as J squared. And then a very simple way to estimate the range of the volume is just to take the dimension and say that the maximum volume has to scale as j to the 3/2. And we notice that the number of levels is increasing faster with j than the range of the volume. So this means that we're packing more and more levels into the range of allowed volumes as we go to higher spins. So this is this gives you a sense of why you might be worried that those additional levels are getting packed in at low volume. In a sense, this is a question about the robustness as we change J's of a gap in the volume spectrum. Okay, on the next slide, I pose the final puzzle, which is what does it mean to thermalize geometry? We're familiar with thermalization in other contexts, but in the gravitational context, it's a little less obvious. This has interesting connections to several issues surrounding black holes. Already in the 80s, Bekenstein introduced a fundamental bound on the rate at which you can transfer information. If you send a message, the rate at which it can transfer information is necessarily less than the energy of the message divided by h bar. So just to give a comparison to this bound, Carlo and I recently posted a paper in which we studied thermal equilibrium and in the context of information transfer. And typical information transfer rate is the temperature divided by h bar. So this Bekenstein bound is huge in comparison to the typical rate at which information is transferred. On the other hand, already in Bekenstein's early work, and later Hod also, has argued that black holes saturate this bound. They thermalize as quickly as you possibly can. And so, if, for example, in Hod's work, he considered a perturbation of the black hole and the rate at which it relaxes and found that it saturates this bound. String theorists have also taken up this this inquiry. Sacchino and Susskind, in a different context, investigated black holes in string theory and noticed that they also saturate this bound and have called them fast scramblers. This is a useful term that I'll use throughout the talk. Okay, in the next slide, we're now on slide five. The strategy of the talk will be to see whether we can say something about these interesting puzzles using the polyhedral volume proposed by Bianchi, Donna, and Speziale. This volume is defined most simply just by saying that it's the operator that gives you the volume of a quantum polyhedron. An important technical tool throughout the talk will be to look at this in the semi-classical limit. So on the left here, I've pictured a spin network with a grain of space at the center and a link labeled by the spin J, which in the semi-classical limit becomes a pentahedron with a face area A. Okay, on the next slide, I give the outline for the talk. So in order to learn new things about the volume operator, we have to go beyond the tetrahedron, which has already been well studied. So the first part of the talk will focus on the pentahedron, which, contrary to early expectations, actually has quite a rich geometry. So I'd like to tell you a little about that geometry, and in particular, show you that the pentahedral volume formula can be analytically solved for in terms of the given area vectors, which we usually take as given in the polyhedral picture. In the second part of the talk, I want to give you some background information that's more general about chaos and, in particular, the quantization of classically chaotic systems. And then in the final part of the talk, I'll explore what this volume dynamics has to tell us about quantum gravity. And next slide. So by now, the Minkowski theorem is quite familiar to this community. To a closure relation of area vectors, there corresponds a unique convex polyhedron. But there is an aspect of this theorem that's worth emphasizing, which is only in existence in a uniqueness theorem. It tells you nothing about how to actually find this polyhedron. So I'll call the process that goes from the given area vectors to the polyhedron Minkowski reconstruction. And that's something that will show up in the talk. Is there a question?
Sorry, it's Perimeter Institute. We just joined. Can you tell us where you are so we can catch up?
Certainly. We're on slide 7.
Can you give us a short summary? Sorry.
I posed three questions at the beginning of the talk. I asked what we can say about gravitational divergences. whether there's a volume gap in loop gravity, and what the status of thermalization in loop gravity is. And I said that I was going to try and attack these questions by looking at the polyhedral volume proposal, and that I would focus on the pentahedron.
Thank you.
All right. So I was just emphasizing the fact that the Minkowski theorem doesn't tell us how to build the polyhedron that it guarantees. So on the next slide, slide 8, I look at how we can describe the geometry of the pentahedron given its area vectors. In particular, I'd like to know what the volume is. So assume that we're given the pentahedron at the left of this slide. We can find its volume by geometrical construction. So consider extending the left and right edges of face 1, continuing them until they cross. They certainly will cross because they both lie in the same plane. They lay in face 1. And similarly, do the same for face 2. Those two edges will cross and meet all at a point, the vertex of this new tetrahedron that I've constructed in the central figure. During this process, we certainly have increased the area of the face 1. So let me introduce three scalings, alpha, beta, and gamma, which take the area of the original pentahedral face 1, alpha does, and scales it to the area of the tetrahedron at the right. So these phase scalings are going to play an important role in what follows, and this is how they're defined. On the next slide, I notice that these three parameters, alpha, beta, and gamma, are necessarily greater than 1. Because the tetrahedral faces have larger areas than the pentahedron that we started with. Furthermore, we can find them explicitly. The closure relation for the tetrahedron that appears at the right of the slide is written in the middle. And by dotting A2 cross A3 into that formula, we can isolate alpha. And alpha is equal to a ratio of triple products of area vectors. So the phase scalings needed to complete this closure are definite functions of the area vectors. Okay, next slide. This continuation process also suggests the formula for the pentahedral volume. We can calculate the volume as the volume of the tetrahedron that appears at the right of the slide minus the volume of the small dash tetrahedron at the top of the central figure. The tetrahedral volumes we know how to calculate in terms of area vectors. They're just triple products of any three of the area vectors. And these scaled tetrahedral things just come from scaling with alpha, beta, and gamma. So the first term in parentheses, for example, comes from the large tetrahedron. So this gives us an explicit formula for the volume of the pentahedron in terms of the area vectors, which we assume are known. Okay, next slide is slide 9. In principle, that's all we need in order to perform a Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. We know the volume as a function of our variables. We set the Hamiltonian equal to that volume, and then we can use Bohr-Sommerfeld conditions to study the quantized values of this volume operator. Unfortunately, this won't work. And there are two reasons for that. And the first one I'll explain now, but the second one won't make sense until we go through the middle part of the talk, so I'll come back to it. So the first one has to do with the fact that when I drew this pentahedron, I just chose an adjacency for it. It's fiducial choice here. And so faces 1, 2, and 3 are adjacent to all the other faces, but faces 5 and 4 aren't adjacent to each other. So for that reason, I'll call this a 5-4 pentahedron, because that, in essence, tells me all the important information about the adjacency. So this 5-4 pentahedron is just a fiducial choice, and I really need to tell you a more general formula for the volume. So let's go to the next slide.
Before you go to the next slide, what does it mean to say won't work? I mean, something that works for tetrahedrons is not working now, or what?
As I said, there are two issues. One is that I haven't actually told you the full formula for the volume. Once we've sorted that out, then it seems that Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization should work. The second issue, which I'll talk about in the middle of the talk, is that the tetrahedron turns out to be an integrable system. And the fact that it's an integrable system makes Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization work, makes it applicable. If it turns out that the pentahedron is a chaotic system, then Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization is not applicable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, slide 10. So what's difficult about this Minkowski reconstruction? Numerical experience from Bianchi, Donan, Speziale, and also from Lasserre, who's worked on this problem for a long time, shows that the difficult part of the Minkowski reconstruction is determining the adjacency. Once you know the adjacency of the polyhedron, then building it is not so difficult. In general, the adjacency problem is quite difficult, but here I'll show you that the introduction of these phase scalings, alpha, beta, and gamma, actually completely solves the adjacency problem. So on the next slide, slide 11, I give you a sense of how this goes. Let me introduce shorthand WIJK for the triple product of AI with AJ and AK. And let's not assume we know the adjacency of this pentahedron pictured at right. And let's just write down the closure relations for different adjacencies, say the 5-4 and the 5-3. Now we can solve for the gamma parameters. And notice that these solutions are just reciprocals of one another. That is, gamma 2 is equal to 1 over gamma 1. But remember, the geometrical interpretation of the phase scalings, they have to scale the pentahedral face to the larger tetrahedral face. And so they have to be greater than 1. But this means that if gamma 1 is greater than 1, then certainly gamma 2 is not. And the constructibility of these two pentahedra is mutually exclusive. So this is a very basic demonstration that 5-4 and 5-3 pentahedra can't both be constructible given a set of area vectors, and you can actually calculate which one is. By doing a full analysis of all the parameters and all the adjacency classes, you find that alpha, beta, and gamma completely determine the adjacency. Okay. So I summarize these findings on the next slide. This is a sort of phase diagram for pentahedra. I've given you a section of the alpha-beta plane at fixed gamma, gamma equals 1.7. And all within the central light blue region, the 5-4 pentahedron is constructible. In these other regions, which I've marked by the two triangular faces, the other pentahedra are constructible. So the volume of the pentahedron that I just derived only applies in the central blue region. And on the next slide, you can repeat the construction for any adjacency. It works the exact same way. And I give you the formula in the 2-1 region. By joining the various formulas that apply in each region, you have a definition of the volume of a pentahedron for all pentahedra. So this is a good point for questions, if there are any. All right. Next slide. So now I turn to the relationship between classical chaos and its quantization. So this is well-known things, but not so common in the loop gravity community, so I thought it would be worth reviewing. Sommerfeld and Epstein introduced a generalization of Bohr's condition that the angular momentum should be quantized. And they did this using the action. So the action for a periodic motion should be quantized in terms of Planck's constant. They also generalized this to systems with multiple degrees of freedom. I'll say F degrees of freedom. And if the system is separable, they just noted that you could do this action integral for each of the separate motions and have F quantization conditions. Einstein wasn't satisfied with this state of affairs, though. In 1917, so soon after he was thinking about general relativity, he noted that this quantization condition isn't invariant under phase-space changes of coordinates, and asked that we come up with a better one. So on the next slide, I give you his approach to the problem. He was also thinking about central force problems at the time, and he noted that in configuration space, trajectories cross, but the momenta at any such crossing are distinct. So on the next slide, you can see a picture of the lift of this trajectory into phase space. And he noticed that in particular for these central force problems, there's a nice torus that arises because the two sheets of the lifting join at the edges of the angular region in configuration space. Next slide. So using this phase-space geometry, he followed Poincaré and considered the phase-space invariant form the sum over I, Pi, dQi. And I'm sorry, the D at the top of that should be an F. This is OPA, the number of degrees of freedom. And adding to this phase-space invariant, he recognized that the topology of the torus would be unchanged under these phase-space coordinate changes. So an invariant way to state the quantization conditions is to say that you should integrate this full p dot dq over the distinct cycle of the torus. And the torus will have exactly f cycle, the number of degrees of freedom. So this gives you f quantization condition. So that's already quite a nice result, and this is called the Einstein, Brillouin, and Keller quantization because it was so early that nobody remembered this result, and Brillouin and Keller had to rediscover it. But Einstein went on to say more. On the next slide, I illustrate his thoughts with billiards. So a billiard is just a free particle allowed to bounce in a billiard table. With the usual reflection conditions at the boundary. And depending on the shape of the billiard, you have very different behavior. So in frame A, we have a circular billiard, and you can see that the trajectory crosses itself, but much like the central force problem, it does so with two distinct momenta. The thing that Einstein appreciated is that this might not always happen, and the stadium billiard on the upper right illustrates this. For more complex boundary conditions, you can have a trajectory that crosses itself an arbitrary number of times at a given point, and so you don't have this nice lift into phase space where you know what the topology is, and you can argue for an invariant quantization condition. This was the issue that Einstein appreciated. Before moving on, let me make one other comment that's easily made with these billiards. The quadrupole billiard illustrates that the general circumstance is that different initial conditions actually have different behavior. So for some initial conditions, you have nice integrable type behavior as in frame C, and for other initial conditions, you have chaotic type behavior, as in frame B. Okay, next slide, and I'm on slide 19. So Einstein was completely correct. Quantizing, and of course I mean this in the spectral sense, finding the level values, quantizing classically chaotic systems is a difficult problem. And things remained at an impasse, essentially, until Wigner introduced random matrix theory in the 60s. So let me just, this is not a good time to summarize all of random matrix theory, so let me just try and give you the key idea. The idea is that for very complicated Hamiltonians, complicated interactions, we should treat the Hamiltonian as a random matrix, and that it's only subject to certain symmetries that we know have to be there, hermeticity and perhaps time reversal or parity invariance, depending on the system. So on slide 20, I show you several spectra. In order to compare these spectra to each other in a meaningful way, we have to renormalize them. So these aren't the physical spectra. These have been renormalized so that they all have the same average level spacing. The process of doing this, of renormalizing them, is called unfolding in the parlance. You can see that there's quite different character to these different spectra. At the left, we have the uniform spectrum, characteristic, for example, of a harmonic oscillator. In column A, we have a Poissonian spectrum. This is a characteristic of integrable systems. And in particular, notice that there's a lot of degeneracy. The little arrows at the right of the spectra indicate that there are two levels so close that we can't resolve them on this plot. Column C and D illustrate two much more complicated systems, neutron bouncing off an erbium nucleus, and the cyanide billiard, which is a classic example of one of these chaotic billiards. And you'll notice that there's much less degeneracy in both of these spectra. Next slide. So the outcome of all of this was to shift the focus away from detailed information about the spectrum and towards a statistical description of the spectrum. So in the plot here, I've plotted the level spacing S, which tells you the difference between two neighboring spectral levels, and then on the vertical axis, the probability of that level spacing. Is there a question? Okay. The dark curve gives you an early approximation of Wigner's for his random matrix spectra. This is called the Wigner surmise. And the dashed curve gives you the results for this probability distribution from integrable systems. This is derived in semi-classics, and it's just a Poissonian distribution. Then the histogram gives you numerical results for the cyanide billiard, and you can see that there's a remarkably good agreement with the Wigner surmise. In the early 80s, Bohigas, Giannoni, and Schmidt conjectured that there's a connection between chaos and random matrices, and in particular that these two spectra, the Wigner's prediction and this spectra of such systems should agree. The proof of this conjecture has only appeared in the last 5 years, and I give one reference here. Before we leave that slide, let me comment that there's a clear difference in the statistics of these two spectral behaviors. This is particularly apparent at small level separation, that is small s. Classically integrable systems, as we saw in the examples in the previous slide, tend to have lots of degeneracy. So the probability distribution is large at small level spacing. While classically chaotic systems tend to exhibit what's called level repulsion. but there's very little degeneracy at small s. So this will be important for our investigations of the pentahedron, which I turn to now. Okay, before discussing chaos explicitly, let me describe a little bit about the phase space of the pentahedron for you, just to orient you. And it's easiest to do that by considering first the tetrahedral phase space. So we're going to fix four areas. And at the left of this slide, I've drawn the closure condition for the four area vectors. Despite the fact that I've drawn it in the plane, this is actually in three dimensions. The coordinates of the phase space are the dashed diagonal of this quadrilateral figure. And because the area vectors have the interpretation of angular momenta, know that the magnitude of this diagonal generates a rotation. In particular, it rotates the 1 and 2 vectors so that the angle between the left wing and the right wing of this figure changes. So these are the two coordinates on the phase space. If you look at the extreme values of the diagonal, you find that the topology of the phase space is actually spherical. So the phase space is depicted in the center of the diagram. And this is all consistent with the geometry that we know. We fixed the four areas. A point of the phase space is two more quantities. So we have six quantities that determine a classical tetrahedron, just as the six edge lengths do. Okay, on the next slide, I say similar things about the pentahedron. So here we have, again, the closure condition. It consists of five vectors now. So there are two diagonals. So we have two momentum coordinates. And the two angles conjugate to those momenta. So these, I'll refer to this diagram familiarly as a butterfly diagram. The central triangle is like a body, and the left two are like wings that flap when we change these two areas. I'm sorry, change these two angles. So the first thing to say about this is that this tells us the number of degrees of freedom of this phase space. It's a 2-degree of freedom problem. And there's a nice statement we can make in general, which is that if you randomly hand me a Hamiltonian in 2 degrees of freedom, generically it exhibits chaos. So this is one of our first indicators that we may expect chaos in the system. Of course, we need to look at the details of the pentahedron also. So on the next slide, just one more diagram about the phase space. The two momenta are subject to triangle conditions, triangle inequalities. And so we know that the phase space consists of a convex region in in the P1, P2 plane. And at each point of this region, we have two angles. So we have a torus. So this is so that one way to visualize the phase space is as a torus bundle over this convex region. Okay. In the next slide, we're now on 26. I just remind you of the volume formulas that I derived earlier in the talk. And in particular, notice that the alpha is, again, a ratio of triple products, and so are beta and gamma. So this is an extremely nonlinear function of the area vectors, and even more so of the phase space coordinates. So such a nonlinear function, we have to investigate numerically. All right, next slide.
Sorry, in the phase space picture, is there a boundary to the open region that's short?
The boundary consists of those when you saturate the triangle inequality.
So the boundary is included. It's a manifold boundary, is it?
Yes.
The phase space manifold boundary. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, slide 27 gives you an introduction to some of the first numerical results. So if you look back at slide 26, there's a possibility, which is that the volume dynamics might take you from one adjacency class to another by crossing the boundary between these two adjacency classes. Investigating this numerically, you find that this actually does occur. So slide 27 shows you a picture for how this happens. So I introduce a Schlegel diagram. If you take the pentahedron and project it into one of its faces, here I've projected it into the back face, the 3 face, and then I've erased the 3 label just to make the diagrams uncluttered. So the Schlegel diagram A corresponds to the pentahedron above it. The volume dynamics allows for that edge that separates face 1 and 2 to go to 0, to collapse to 0, and then reopen in the opposite direction, just as the Packner moves that everyone is familiar with. So this transitions you from a 5-4 pentahedron to a 1-2 type pentahedron, for example. And so this actually occurs in the volume dynamic.
What is volume dynamic? Because there are people here who don't know that term.
Certainly. So as I said in the early part of the talk, this is when you take the Hamiltonian of your system to be the volume that you're studying. Here, the volume of the pentahedron. So it's just like if I wanted to study the energy levels of hydrogen, I would take the hydrogen Hamiltonian. Here I'm taking the volume as Hamiltonian in order to study the spectrum of the volume.
So this is quantum operator, because you could also have done this in a classical phase space, but you are doing it quantum mechanically, is that correct?
No, at this point I'm just studying it classically. Thank you for that clarification. Yes, I'm numerically integrating the equations of motion classically.
Okay, so you've got a phase space, you've got a synthetic structure, you use volume as Hamiltonian, and then see what happens.
Exactly. Another question?
Yes, a dumb question.
Okay.
What is the commutation relation of the phase space?
That's actually a very nice question. It comes from the fact that we assume that these area vectors are angular momenta, and it's got the standard commutation relations of angular momenta. So in fancy terminology, it's the Lie Poisson bracket of those angular momenta.
So these are not inherited from the dynamics of the quantum geometry.
So this comes directly out of the loop gravity formalism. Since we label the links of the spin network by spins, by angular momenta, the semi-classical approximation of those is area vectors, which are angular momenta.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
I think it is confusing because, on the other hand, these G's from loop quantum gravity are all quantum mechanical objects. But here, you're using them to get a synthetic structure, and after that, you're doing everything classically. Am I correct about this?
Yes. I'm trying to invert the usual paradigm. I'm trying to use classical mechanics to learn about the quantum system. So I'm building a classical system that has all the right properties to talk to the quantum system that we're interested in, namely the volume, and then I'm studying the dynamics of that classical system.
Okay.
All right. Slide 28. So I just want to tell you a few more of the numerical results, analytical and numerical, that led me to some conjectures that I gave, for example, at the Perimeter Institute this summer. So the phase space is certainly mixed, containing both stable orbits and unstable orbits. You just see this by taking some initial conditions and finding that they give rise to trajectories that you can integrate for long times and that give you the same toroidal structure that Einstein found in the central force problem. So so some initial conditions give stable orbit. The instability of other orbits is something that I'll give you more evidence for later in the talk. In analogy with the billiard systems, I conjecture that adjacency changes should lead to instability. You can see this in the stadium billiard. The stadium billiard is taken by just taking a circle, cutting it in half, and then taking those two halves away from each other. And this introduces a lack of smoothness in the boundary, as for example, where the black arrow points. And this is well studied in the billiards community, and they've shown that this is connected with chaos. So the fact that we have these adjacency changes in the pentahedron makes it quite likely that there should be instability also. Finally, the fact that we go from one adjacency region to another and that I'm expecting instability means that the consequence of this should be that thermalization effectively erases the adjacency information. So these were ideas that I put out this summer. Unbeknownst to me, and wonderfully, Bernd Mueller's group at Duke has simultaneously been working on the pentahedron for some time. Bernd Mueller and his graduate student Chris Coleman Smith were studying the problem numerically. They didn't have access to the analytic results I told you above. And so they simplified to investigation of just the equi-area pentahedron, the one with all phase areas equal. Both groups, myself and the Mueller group, had trouble integrating for a long time. In their case, it was because of numerical instabilities. At any rate, the classical characterization of chaos would be to use a Lyapunov exponent. That is, take two nearby initial conditions and study their exponential divergence. If they continue to exponentially diverge for a long time, then they have positive Lyapunov exponents, and that tells you that there's chaos. But since neither group could integrate for long times, the Mueller group had the wonderful idea to focus on local stability. So the next two slides, I want to tell you a little bit about their results. Okay. Slide 29 takes three figures from their paper, which will be published either this week or next, also in PRD. And all three figures are in the configuration plane, the Q1, Q2 plane. In the left figure, they've plotted contours of constant volume. In the central figure, they've used my characterization of the adjacency to plot the different adjacency regions. And then in the right figure, they've plotted what's called a local Lyapunov exponent. This is the infinitesimal time limit of the Lyapunov exponent, the very short time Lyapunov exponent. It's calculated by looking at the eigenvalues of the Hessian of the Hamiltonian. So these figures have lots of interesting information in them. On the left, small volume is colored blue and large volume yellow. And so we see that contours of small volume cross adjacency boundaries frequently. Furthermore, the conjecture that instability arises at the adjacency boundaries is well supported in the right figure, where you see that the hottest, most unstable colors appear right along the adjacency boundaries. Okay. So, as I mentioned, the nicest characterization of chaos would be long-time Lyapunov exponents. But in missing that information, it would be interesting to look at the intermediate time, so slightly longer times than these local Lyapunov exponents.
Sorry, Jim, just,
Yes.
One question about these figures. So I'm trying to understand what information it gives me about the dynamics. So is the idea that if I take a random initial condition, somehow it will be expelled very rapidly from the unstable region and spend lots of time in the cold spot?
So if you take a random initial condition at large volume, you're going to be closer to the stable regions. The blue regions in the right part are stable, and they're also the regions of large volume. However, if you take an initial condition at small volume, you have lots of instability all around you. You wander through the volume surface rapidly, and you cross adjacency regions rapidly.
Then do you finally end up in a region of large volume where you stay a long time?
No, you can't. This is the volume dynamics we're considering. You have to preserve the volume.
Oh, right. Okay.
All right. Slide 30. So to investigate intermediate times, they took a large ensemble of initial conditions in each volume surface. And here are four different cases. And they studied the ensemble average of the Lyapunov exponents for intermediate time. So this is not as rigorous as a long-time Lyapunov exponent, but it gives you a good indicator, especially because these intermediate Lyapunov exponents tend to level out over time in their ensemble average. And you'll notice that for all four cases, the leveling out is at a positive value. So this is a strong indicator that there's instability throughout the phase space of the pentahedron. And you'll also notice that for small volumes, such as the black circles at the top of the figure, you have the most instability. So this is the more quantitative version of the statement that I just gave Laurent. Okay. So let me return to the question of what does all of this mean for quantum gravity. So in the central part of the talk, I told you that chaos implies that there's level repulsion, but that all of those statements were in the context of an unfolded spectrum. So to ask about whether there's a volume gap, we have to consider the refolding. We have to go back to the physical spectrum and ask that the physical happens in the physical spectrum. So when the unfolding process tends to spread out tightly packed states and to condense loosely packed states. So what I'm emphasizing here is that we have to understand not just whether there's chaos, but what's the behavior of the density of states. Is there a question?
Yes, can you just remind us what you mean by the folded and unfolded spectrum?
Certainly. Remember, to look at the random matrices, we had to normalize the spectral spacing so that we can compare different systems, for example, and so that we can make a universal conjecture. So to do that, we generally just take the average spectral spacing to be 1. And the process that takes your given spectrum to the spectrum that has average spectral spacing of 1 is called unfolding.
Okay, thank you.
So I tried to motivate why we need to know about the density of states. But there's a remarkably nice thing that we can say here about the density of states, also at the semi-classical level. Let's consider small volumes. In order to support a quantum state, you need to have a phase space volume, I'll call that V phi here, of at least h bar to the number of degrees of freedom. Here, there are 2 degrees of freedom, so the phase space volume has to go at least as h bar squared. But notice that the zero physical volume configurations here are points of this phase space. They're the center of this torus that I've drawn, the left-hand side, the bottom in the center, and the corner. So there are 4 flat configurations here. This means that around that point, you have very few quantum states. you can only support a few. And of course, more and more as you consider larger and larger physical volumes. So what this tells you is that the density of states has to go to zero at zero physical volume. So this concern that I just raised a moment ago, that refolding the spectrum might mess up this level repulsion, is not warranted here. The density of states is small at small physical volumes, and therefore level repulsion is in full effect. One of the major conclusions of this talk, then, is that chaotic volume dynamics in the pentahedral volume picture leads robustly to a volume gap through the mechanisms of level repulsion and small density of states. Okay, next slide. Okay, I wanted to compare this very briefly to previous results, since the volume gap has been questioned in the past. In particular, one of the works that is most associated with this is the huge numerical effort of Bruneman and Rideout, where they calculated 10 to the 12 eigenvalues of the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume all the way up for largest spins of 22. So their numerical results are shown in the right-hand side. This is again for the case of a five-valent node, which in the classical limit corresponds to a pentahedron. And what they noticed, you can just focus on the highest black curve here. It's the one where they include all of their results. They noticed in the inset that they had more and more eigenvalues appearing at low volume. So this led them to wonder whether the volume gap, whether there was a volume gap for more complicated grains of space. So for comparison, I wanted to remind you again what the structure of the pentahedral volume is, and that's at the left. So the reason, there are several reasons for us having different results, and some of them are quite technical, but I want to just give you the two simplest reasons. The early Ravelli-Solon and Ashtekar-Lewandowski volumes has a result that higher valent nodes can be decomposed into sums of lower valent nodes. That is, you have an additivity of the volume grain. The pentahedral volume, on the other hand, does not have this property. You can't decompose the pentahedral volume into a sum of tetrahedral pieces. It's quite a different interaction between the pieces that appears in the formula at left. In particular, this means that it's possible, we know already that the tetrahedron is integrable. That's what Eugenio Bianchi and I showed in our Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. And so in particular, this means that the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume may be staying near integrability by imposing this structure of additivity on the volume grain. There are different advantages to the different volume proposals, and what this points us to is investigating whether this additivity property is something we think is really there, or something that is an extra structure that we were imposing on the volume. Next slide. All right, so I wanted to...
Sorry, just a question about the difference. Question about the difference. There's also the fact that, for understand properly, the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume doesn't need the, you know, it's universal. You don't need any information about the connectivity, right? How the pentagram is, whereas your volume depends on, you know, which faces are connected to which other faces.
You got right.
So that's a fundamental difference. It's like the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume doesn't, you know, has the information about whatever the geometrical object.
That's right. It has no information about adjacency in the semi-classical limit.
So also to add to that, you would have to say how you would even define this pentahedral volume operator on the quantum gravity Hilbert space, because you have the square root of these alpha, beta, and gamma, which should be expressed in terms of fluxes, and then rational function of fluxes.
Certainly, and the definition has been given, for example, in the first work of Bianchi, Donna, and Speciale. They give a sort of coherent state definition of this operator. In fact, the results that I'm seeing depend very little on the operator ordering or anything else that you choose about how to define this operator, because they're defined in the semi-classical limit. So any good definition of the polyhedral volume should have the same semi-classical limit. And all of the things that I'm indicating are generic features of that limit. So these quantization ambiguities, while very important for the quantum theory, aren't important for the conclusions that I'm saying here.
Your results are semi-classical.
Yes.
So I thought that, I mean, if you say that looking at a problem semi-classically, I obtain that there is a volume gap. That is to say, I obtain the result that there aren't kind of continuum of eigenstates, so to say, approaching the zero volume. There is no contradiction, right? I mean, one would just say that is just a limitation of the semi-classical method, that you're leaving out some things that are there in the full quantum theory. So why is this not a kind of a valid viewpoint?
So I think that semi-classics is actually often underestimated in the strength of what it says about quantum systems. Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization of the tetrahedron is in excellent agreement with the exact quantization of loop gravity all the way down to quite small spins. I think it's dangerous to ignore the indications coming from semi-classics.
No, but you yourself just told us in the beginning, right? I'm just confused. I'm just trying to get clarity. You just told us in the beginning that semi-classical methods and this Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization, etc., is good for integrable systems. It's not good for chaotic systems.
Good. And now I'm telling you that there is a semi-classical technique that applies to chaotic systems. It's just not Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization.
I agree, but I'm not saying that one should not take the semi-classical thing seriously, but I'm just confused. I mean, are you saying that Brüneman and Rideout made a further assumption when they actually carried out this calculation, and that assumption is something that you think is probably not valid? Or are you saying that they did not make any assumption in carrying out this calculation that you have on transparency 32? And if that actually is a numerical result for the eigenvalues of the volume operator, why can we not conclude that in full quantum theory there is no volume gap, and that even though the new improved semi-classical technique is giving you some other result, that is the fault of the semi-classical approximation?
So what I'm saying is I'm not saying that there's any mistake in Brüneman and Rideout. Their work is perfect. What I'm saying is that there are different volume operator proposals on the table. The Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume operator has this additivity property that I mentioned. And that's an assumption that's built into its construction. And I'm questioning whether we want that assumption or not.
Can I comment on that to clarify? So what you're studying is really the polyhedral volume, which is very, very different from the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume. That's your main point. And it relates to the question of somebody else from 532, this alpha, beta, gamma. I mean, it would be interesting, you wrote them in terms of fluxes, but when you write them in terms of fluxes, they are like ratios of triple product of areas. So in some sense, they are, you know, they look very singular. So that's an additional feature at the quantum level that is radically different, where there is no singularity, you know, in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski volume operator.
Yes, I think that's what Norbert Bodendorfer was just pointing out a moment ago. It's a very different structure.
Please go ahead.
All right. Let's look at slide 33. So I just wanted to return to the puzzles I stated at the beginning. So loop gravity continues to indicate that there are physical cutoffs at the Planck scale. So if you take the polyhedral volume proposal seriously, there's a robust volume gap, and it's due to chaos and a low density of states at small volumes. Meanwhile, other work that's happening here in Marseille, Aldo Riello is finding that the divergences at large J, large distance, are tamer than was first indicated. They're only logarithmic. So this is work that just appeared this week or last week. And so what I'd like to say, and what I was really struck by in reading Hermann Nicolai's review, is that he did not have this picture of physical cutoffs at the Planck scale. So the particle physicists aren't hearing the structure that we're seeing from us. And so I assume there's even disagreement within the community about it, but there's a clear picture, a coherent and consistent view of what's happening with gravitational divergences so far. On the next slide, I also wanted to discuss this thermalization. This is a little more speculative, but a generic consequence of chaos is efficient thermalization. If you have a strongly chaotic system, you know that it thermalizes. So what we see from this pentahedral volume dynamic is that eigenstates of quantum volume are spread out over different adjacencies. And so, for example, a coherent state that's peaked around a particular volume will rapidly transit through adjacencies. And the thermalization of geometry in this picture is rapid loss of adjacency information. So this is an interesting perspective on what thermalization means about geometry. And in particular, I'm quite interested to investigate whether this new window on the thermalization of geometry can tell us something about the extreme thermalization that we see in black holes. So with that, I'll conclude. I wanted to take the opportunity to wish you a very happy Chinese New Year, which is just this Sunday, and to thank you again.
Okay, any further questions?
I have a question about thermalization. It seems to me that what you were showing in your, the way I understood what you were showing in your results about the spectrum is that at, you know, for low eigenvalues, so for small volume, then the system is chaotic and the Lyapunov exponents are big and the system transits from one region to another. But then for large volume, in fact, the Lyapunov exponents are very small, therefore Bohr Sommerfeld quantization should work there. That would have been my understanding, that there's a completely different regime for large volume and small volume.
That's absolutely correct. I didn't want to go into that subtlety, but yes, you can apply the Bohr Sommerfeld method to stable orbits, and the stable orbits are appearing at large volumes. In fact, this explains the sort of simplistic model that I introduced at the beginning. As we pack more and more states into the given range of allowed volumes, the extra packing is happening at high volumes, where there's lots of degeneracy in the Poissonian statistics of integrable states.
Okay. Is this a comment?
Yeah.
Yes, the speculative comments about thermalization are only based on the behavior of the volume operator taken as a Hamiltonian. So it's fair to say that they're only interesting or reliable in something like the limit of large cosmological constants. And because it's only if the cosmological constant term of the Hamiltonian dominates, or the Hamiltonian constraint dominates, that seems to be relevant to the behavior of a physical system. When you consider the other term, which is where the gravitational dynamics is, it's much more complicated because it couples adjacent symplexes or adjacent nodes to each other.
Your comment is very well taken. You're absolutely correct. I'm just trying to learn a little about what the thermalization of geometry is. I'm not trying to say that we have that I have any results or any big things to say about black holes. I'm just intrigued by this adjacency information being washed out.
And maybe rather than black holes, you could be thinking about something like quantum de Sitter space-time with small radius or large cosmological constants.
Yes, absolutely.
I have another comment because we had this very positive conclusion that we have a clear, you know, somehow consistent picture. But at the same time, in your talk, you mentioned that there is some kind of tension in the field, right? And you didn't really emphasize about it. So let me push on this point that seems to be a painful point. Is that so? You emphasize the fact that if we go to higher, you know, valency nodes, then we have really two different definitions of the volume. One is the polyhedral volume, and the other one is the Eshnikar-Lewandowski volume. And you emphasize that, you know, it's not a difference in details, that these two definitions of volume are fundamentally different in a sense, as far as I understand, they are physically fundamentally different. One leads to a discrete spectra, whereas the other one leads to a piling up of eigenvalue at zero volume. And in some sense, maybe one leads to, you know, a nice level spacing or exclusion principle, and the other does not. So it seems to me that we have a tension in the field now, which is, you know, which of these volume, if any of the two, which one of these two is correct, right?
Yes, thanks for that comment.
To amplify a little bit again, I mean, extremely, it's not just a volume operator, it's the whole paradigm, right? I mean, the volume operator that, you know, Jurek and I had, or Carlo and Lee had, those were defined in the semi-analytic category. The volume operator that is now being considered, the polyhedral one, is really in the piecewise linear category. So I think it really goes down to that. It's not so much that, you know, we have the same kinematical framework and then there's a slight difference to that. And so I think it's a very good point. And my personal point of view would be that if, in fact, you get more and more interesting results in one category, I mean, I think this is just a freedom. I mean, it's a mathematical freedom. And which is the one, and they're all mathematically consistent. The question is, which is more useful physically, for example, for understanding the ultraviolet problems and so on and so forth. That is the question. It's not so much what is right, what is wrong. I mean, you know, they're just different paradigms. Then the statement is that, I mean, it's like what happens with differential equations, right? Should we consider only analytic functions or should we consider smooth functions? I mean, there's nothing, neither is wrong, but one thing can be more useful than the other. Then the question is really what Laura was pointing out, namely, we get some consistent picture. Now, here I would disagree, because what does consistent mean? I think there is no inconsistency in having there being an area gap, but there being no volume gap. There is no a priori consistency, it's just feature of quantum geometry, which is counterintuitive. And as far as ultraviolet divergences are concerned, we have to sort of understand it much more detail, right, as to which of them matters. For example, in loop quantum cosmology, the volume never appears, right? I mean, what appears is really area, and that has to do with the fact that the way that the curvature is defined. So I don't think that, I mean, I think that it is true that there is clear choice, but it's not that there is a contradiction. I think we have to be driven by what is really kind of most useful. Again, coming back to this quantum geometry being not intuitive, I mean, I think even if you use the polyhedral volume operator, there would be no simple relation between the areas and the volumes, if you like, in a small volume configurations. Because quantum geometry is not what you thought, it's different from classical geometry, basically. So there's never going to be an exact match between our classical pictures of geometry and quantum picture, whether you are using polyhedral geometry or whether you are using this semi-analytical category. So okay, that's what I wanted to say.
Just a quick comment. Certainly I agree with most things you said. I still think it bears looking at the Ashtekar Lewandowski's property of additivity of the grains of space, as I was calling it, because the features that I'm using here in the polyhedral picture are quite generic. I'm using chaos, which has to do with multiple degrees of freedom, and I'm using the property that at low volume you have less phase space. So these features might even apply in a small change of the Ashtekar-Lewandowski proposal. It's a very generic thing argument that I'm making. It's not strictly applicable only to the pentahedral volume, for example.
But in that proposal, this was not a fundamental property that was used in order to define the volume operator. This is a property that follows the definition of volume operator. If one just used semi-analytical category, there just isn't much other structure that is given to you. And, you know, one was just using the structure that is available in the semi-analytical category. So I really think that the final decision is really which of those things are most useful. And my personal I mean, there's no logic here, but my personal belief is that, in fact, the polyhedral one is likely to be more useful to make direct contact with the confined theory and so on in the near future. So, but I don't think that, I think it's a utility issue.
This is Carlo. I think I agree with everything you say, Abai. I would like to just add one small, very minimal comment. Two things. First, it's an issue of utility, and it also is an issue of context within the theory. What are we doing with one operator, with the other operator, in which context in the theory? The comment I want to make is that when the volume operators were defined, sort of quite some time ago. At least in my experience in the working with Lee, I don't know if you and Jurek had a different perspective, but the focus was entirely on the four volume class, at least in my mind, the focus on the four volume nodes. So a lot of work was put together to make sense and to make them believable and credible operator for tetrahedra. For me, the extension to higher valent nodes was done more or less in a sort of the simplest generalization one can think about. I'm saying that because the two different operators, in fact, agree on the tetrahedra. So we don't have what is the issue here is not the volume operator in the simplest case. The volume is extension of the volume operator to higher valent nodes. This is where the same diverge. On my side, I wasn't surprised that the extension to higher value nodes could be improved for some users.
No, I think when Jurek and I did it, we did not pay any attention to four valent. I mean, in some calculations, in order to actually evaluate the formula, of course, we probably did something. We had just some elementary properties of volume operators. There, we might have calculated using four valent. But for the definition, it really was this piecewise linear category, and I think I'm not sorry, piecewise semi-analytic category, but the edges are piecewise analytic, basically. The valency of vertex played no role in our consideration.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions?
Short comment on this, Norbert from Penn State. As I just said, I mean, the definition of the volume operators, the main conceptual differences there, as Abe was putting it, on the one hand, you can just write down the integral over the square root of the metric determinant, and then write this in terms of flux, and then quantize it, and this is what you would do in quantizing the theory, or with this pentahedral volume, you really think about this network, you interpret it as some discrete geometry, and you write down a volume operator such that its spectrum or what it gives you matches what you expect this spin network to represent, which is this discrete geometry. And I think that is basically the difference between these two attitudes with the volume operator. And then as as I said, we have to figure out which one's more useful and more correct for the physical results we want to derive.
Yeah, but even the first choice is not so straightforward. I mean, there is in any case a liberalization involved, and there is construction added, so it's not the immediate description, the construction of the operator.
Another comment. This is Eugenio. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, in fact, some of the motivation that we had with Simone and Pietro Donato when introducing this polyhedral volume was a result that Thomas Tiemann presented at the conference in Zakopane. That is, when considering the standard root quantum gravity volume operator and setting the semi-classical limit, it appears to have a good semi-classical picture only in certain very non-trivial situations, for instance for a valent node, so that it will reproduce a cube, and in the other cases it's not clear it has a semi-classical limit. And the picture that I have is that there should be some polyhedron for any valence, and the question was really, can we build an operator that has this property? So that was just a comment.
Can I make the last comment?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, the big issue is whether the theory has controllable ultraviolet divergences and whether it makes physical sense or not. The question is not whether some particular operator or some observable has a discrete spectra or a gap in it. There are lots of quantum field theories where one can study operators which multiply operators together at a point in a way that is divergence, but still the dynamics is normalizable. It seems to me the important questions are dynamical questions about the behavior of spin foam amplitudes in various limits and various situations. Even if the volume operator has no gap, that doesn't mean that the theory doesn't make good physical sense.
But also conversely, the volume operator has a gap, doesn't mean it makes physical sense either.
Absolutely.
So both ways we have to check. So I think that what Nicola's comment, I mean, I agree with her very much that in fact we are not said loudly enough this idea that there are no degrees of freedom in the ultraviolet, the transplanting degrees of freedom, the full theory and so on. But I think the real point is not that. The real point is that, okay, there are no degrees of freedom. But then start with that picture and derive the low energy physics. For example, the plot that you showed about from CERN, right, from the Higgs plot. So derive that.
Hello? Hello, is anyone?